You're listening to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast. I am your host, Alex Gromatsky, and today I'm going to be joined with Sanjay Patke, who has experience in the fintech sector, and he's currently working on a company called Breath AI, which dives all around the importance of breathing, how to regulate breathing, how breathing is correlated to our nervous system, and how it can help with stress and anxiety and depression. So thank you for being on today, and it'd be great to dive into a little bit about your history.
Thanks, Alex, and hello, everybody. My journey in fintech is about 7-8 years old. Prior to that, I was in banking. I was in investment banking and structured credit with JP Morgan, HSBC, and the global banks. Along the way, given that I had started with engineering before banking, my interest was to go back to core engineering, and that's how I switched back to fintech, or rather started exploring fintech, and that's how I'm working with Vayana, which is a supply chain finance technology platform, a global fintech. I also wrote a book called Fintech Future with my experiences of combining finance and tech. It's available on Amazon. It's called Fintech Future, Digital DNA of Finance. And you're right, I think AI is pretty much becoming everyday conversation, everyday word today. And we just have had, NVIDIA becoming a very large $2 trillion market cap company, and a lot of talk about how AI is the next software, the next stage in computing, and so on and so forth. So I do have some work in that space through my health tech venture, which I started about almost 5 years back, which is about improving the health and happiness for all, using breath as the natural medium and understanding the ins and outs of the breath and the heart and other body parameters to be able to predict issues and prevent issues with generous use of AI. So that's a brief background for myself.
I appreciate them. There's quite a few different topics that we can dive into from there. And let's start with the fintech one and what you made you get into that, because you were at JP Morgan and HSBC, as you said. So I'm assuming that you saw some gaps in the market that made you say, hey, we need a solution in the financial technology space, or what made you want to go from investment banking area into technology?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I did engineering before switching over to finance. So I always was interested in how things work and systems work at a more macro level. And what I realized was that while finance sort of deals with a lot of these things, I mean, everything ultimately requires money, right? Money is really almost like the material that makes the whole economy go around, like blood in our body or breath in some sense. But it's not, except for the market side of it, it's not very quantitative. There are a lot of other parts of finance which are still reasonably, in some sense, version 1.0, I think, in a way. A lot of corporate finance is in that mode. So I wanted to figure out a way to integrate the latest in technology, which is nothing else but quantification and automation and then intelligence in one by one to be added into multiple aspects of finance, which has been quite an interesting journey for me, because I've sort of realized during that time and process that still, in a sense, at an early stage of switching over in the world of finance from, let's say, what we were earlier in the world of notes and in the world of coins, to obviously we are in a world of Google Pay and Apple Pay and so on, but that's still pretty early stage of a long-term evolution. where eventually money will become a far more digital, aspects of finance will become far more automated and intelligent, and we are at a very interesting juncture at this point of time. I also realize that finance is a related activity, so anything that happens will require significant support and working with regulators. So, you know, things like crypto and other such decentralized finance and other areas may actually take far longer than what most people imagine, because it's like shipping over years of a very, very large structure, which will take time. So some things will happen fast, some things will happen slow. The consumer spread of fintech is far, far faster already, but the B2B world will be slow, and the government worlds will be even slower. So those are some of the insights that I kind of put out in that book, The Fintech Future.
And what specifically are you working on as it relates to solutions in the fintech space with the company that you're currently involved with?
Yeah, so we are working on the supply chain financing technology platform. So what happens is everything that is bought and sold between two businesses, there is a sale and there is a purchase. And every time that happens, usually there is a certain amount of credit involved. So that can be called trade credit or supply chain finance. Usually it is hard to automate this piece because different banks have different IT systems. The large corporates have their own ERPs, and their vendors or dealers may have very, very basic systems or advanced systems, which typically it's all about the systems not talking to each other or having very, unique ways of interacting with the rest of the world. So we really build bridges between all these systems so that data, which is money in some sense, money is nothing but data in a way, data can seamlessly move between, let's say, a small seller who's a vendor to a large corporation who has a large SAP or other such system, and then to a bank which may have a core banking solution, so that the business is able to easily fund itself as easily as a customer swipes a credit card, right? That's really a very simple transaction, very beautiful user experience, where a lot of things happen behind the behind the swipe or the first time setting up of the limits and so on and so forth. So mimicking that process in the B2B world, which hopefully will then impact all purchase sale transactions in the B2B world, is what we're working on. And it's been an interesting journey over 7 years that I've been part of this. It's a Series D company now in present in India and in Singapore as well as in US, and looking at growing, especially the global piece of it. It also has a trade finance marketplace, which is regulated in India, which is for global trade finance. And that's also part of a very interesting set of new initiatives that I'm working on.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's quite in depth and a very big undertaking, to say the least. And then you also are in the health and wellness space with AI, and as it relates to breathwork. And I think breathwork might stem out of India or not, but how did you really get into breathwork? I've done breathwork once. I have some friends that do it, and it can be quite a powerful experience. What specifically are you doing with breathwork and AI, or with Breathe AI?
Yeah, so I was lucky. I actually learned breathwork or yoga in my school days. My mom is a yoga teacher, but then I forgot over a period of time, as the college career, etc., takes over. And then eventually I kind of had many experiences. Investment banking can be stressful career. At one point, at about the age of 35, I had like 10 wires of in me looking at blood reports because somebody wanted to do a detailed, multiple tests. And then another time I was actually in a flight. This was just about 2.5 years back. I had, I kind of felt very heavy chest, and I wasn't able to even think about how to call the air hostess or talk. And I realized that, when my watch, I had an Apple Watch on that time, and it showed AFib. I didn't know at that time what it meant, but I just realized that something was wrong, and kind of brought back my yoga, subconscious training to sort of just breathe slower and breathe deeper. What is called diaphragmatic breathing. I practiced that for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then my ECG came pretty normal. So I kind of relearned or relived my earlier journey in yoga, and now realize that that probably is, breath is probably the answer to almost every issue that we face in the modern world, whether it is due to the, lack of sleep or stresses, the addictions of various types, the mental health issues from anxiety to depression to all the way, or just the metabolic health issues, whether it is from diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and other metabolic syndrome. I think all of those are ultimately connected to breathing at the very basic level, because that's really the start of the whole organism, right? If one doesn't breathe, one dies. If one doesn't eat, one can still live for a bit of time. So how we breathe and how do we kind of bring it all together, how do we understand how breathing impacts the heart, the brain, the gut, is the kind of things that I'm kind of working on. And it's been a really, really lucky and enjoyable experience to kind of deal with the science aspect of this, the science aspect from exercise physiology to neuroscience to the various branches of medical science. So we basically built a wearable and a mobile app which understands the various body parameters on a continuous basis, and then predicts what may happen, fatigue, resilience, mood, emotions, etc., and then also provides ways to prevent that through breathwork and which means.
That's an interesting observation, because I think you're right, working on your breathwork can calm you down, help you go to sleep. Yeah, I definitely helped me, and sleep is an integral part to health. And as it relates to, like you said, anxiety and stress, if you're stressed out, that's too much cortisol, which is bad for your heart, which is also cancer causing. Breathwork can help you with cortisol management. Yeah. So that's a very interesting point. And same with, depression being more present in the world can help with that, and not having such negative thoughts. So that's a very interesting observation from that side of things. And then the idea that breathwork can control your mood or influence your mood, that makes logical sense. And being able to predict that based on your breath and based on how ramped up you are and how you're breathing. So that's really interesting from that perspective. And how far are you in the development with that? You said there's already a wearable available.
Yeah. It's not yet launched commercially. We're doing a lot of closed user group trials for specific use cases, mental health specific use case in college going teenagers or early adults in some sense, also for women in PCOD and other such cycle issues on sort of disharmony with cycles caused by stress, and also another trial on looking to build another trial on diabetes. And what we do is we built a wearable which understands heart rate variability and breath rate on a continuous basis. And now we are adding on top of that chamber, so one can actually breathe into it, exhale into it through nose, and the two different nostrils will have a different impact on how one breathes. That's also kind of part of the ancient knowledge, the switching between the two nostrils and the cortical asymmetry, the left brain, right brain switching over to each other. So all of this is part of the second version of the wearable. So we're calling it breathable, and we'll be releasing an early version of the breathable, which probably will be the world's first wearable in a couple months, a month and a half.
Oh, that's really exciting. But I got to just back up a second. So are you saying that some people are able to breathe through one nostril at a time? Because I do not think I can do that. I just tried that as you were talking about it. Oh, yeah. Okay, you have to put your finger on it. I was trying to get the left of my right brain to work and try to control only breathing through one nostril.
It is possible, actually, but obviously it requires work. Do you know that at any point of time, usually for most people, one of the two nostrils is dominant. So it's actually not the same flow in both nostrils. That is what is called nasal dominance. So for example, for me, for now, my left is slightly more dominant. It is like 60, 40, that not like 100, 0, it's 60, 40. It will switch. It will switch to maybe right nostril in about an hour or hour and a half or 2 hours. So typically this is like a cycle which is between 45 minutes to about 2.5 hours for most healthy people. And if one is unhealthy, one of the ways in which one can find that out is also if that thing is not happening in a somewhat orderly fashion. It's not like a fixed frequency. It's not like a fixed, not heart rate. Heart rate is not fixed, right? It goes up and down with the demands. The breath rate goes up and down. Similarly, the nasal switching also is slightly variable, but it is important to have switching because otherwise part of science is something that is still kind of being explored in the world of science as to how it impacts the brains. But it is very proven that left nostril is active, then the right part of the brain is active. Similarly, the right nostril is active, the left part of the brain is more active. This relative, obviously, again, not like switching off one part and switching, but relatively using studies which look at EEGs and use of sugar in different parts of the brain, which parts is lighting up slightly more is how that study is done. So it's a very, very, I agree with you, it's a super interesting concept and how it then impacts the rest of the body, because you know we have heart on one side, so it's not like symmetric in some sense, the chest parts. So how does it all connect to each other, and then how does the cardiovascular system work together with the breathing, and how we can bring coherence in the heart, improve the HRV, which is now part of the established bio feedback type mechanism, just by breathing slow and deep, and all of these things are in a sense part of the fusion of the ancient knowledge and the modern science.
So since we were talking on that side of things, I was very much focused out of which nostril I was breathing. So I'm out of the left nostril as well. But how did you know about this type of science, and what got you into that side of things? And by the end of the episode, I'm going to check if I'm breathing out of my right side or not. But it'll be definitely something I'll be thinking more about, and I'll be telling my wife about as well. So and this is part of the yoga practice and some of the things that you were brought up with, that you had this awareness or this knowledge about. And then you said, well, more people should know about this. People probably don't. Or what was the theory behind you getting down this path? And I know you had your experience personally, but.
Yeah. So I had this in-flight experience, like I said. Then I started looking more into how the heart works and how you know, we look at the heart rate. And at that time in that in-flight experience, I knew that my heart rate was very elevated. But that's just one way to look at it. What I didn't know at that time was something called heart rate variability, which I got to kind of learn into depth later, which is nothing but how the heart is able to adjust to different loads, the up and down loads. So if I start running, my heart rate will go up. But if I'm an expert runner, then it will not go up as much as, inexperienced runner or an elite super athlete will have his resting heart rate at not more than 50, maybe, and so on and so forth. So the ability of the heart to do more work, more efficiently, but at the same time, changing is something that I realized is important. And then I realized that what is also important in the modern world is not just the heart's ability to rev up, but it's actually the ability to rev down. Because today's world, I think all of us are far more sort of continuously inundated with different information, insights, whether it's coming from various screens that we have or just the amount of information overload. So there is more stressors in the way that it is called, but more as just information to process. Then I realized there's something called sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. And the sympathetic nervous system is the one that makes us process all this information, which is very similar to processing, let's say, since our brains and our genes are pretty much made in the time that we were not in the modern world, but in the world before, let's say when we were in the wild, the caveman world, where there was one was in a jungle and there was a tiger in front, and one had to process that and come up with what is the most appropriate solution for survival, which at that time would have been fight or flight. So the fight or flight is kind of associated with sympathetic system, and the sympathetic system makes us increase the heart rate and increase the breath rate, get more blood to the extremities so that we can run or we can fight, sometimes freeze, but fight or flight. And the other part, which is where the heart rate needs to come down when that danger is over, is part of what is called as parasympathetic nervous system, which actually brings the heart rate lower and which calms down the system. And then I realized, I started working into this more and more, that the way our bodies are constructed is it can either be in fight or flight mode, or it can be in the other mode, which is called rest and digest and grow, and rejuvenate mode. We cannot be in both modes at one time. So at a very, very basic cellular level, at the atomic level in the biology in some sense, the cell can be in the fight or flight mode or rest and digest mode, not at the same time. And the more we keep ourselves at fight or flight mode continuously, the more stress accumulates and the more cortisol that you mentioned sort of starts becoming more and more commonplace rather than once in a while experience. And all that is linked in a beautiful way with heart rate variability, because more the heart rate variability, the more the ability of the heart to calm down after a need is over, whether it's a physical sort of exercise or a very concentrated mental problem that one is trying to solve. After the problem is solved, one comes back to the baseline in some sense. And in a way, that is connected to the sleep, because that is really the job of the sleep, to bring everything back to the baseline, process all information, and so on and so forth. So sleep is where the parasympathetic system is at its peak. The days when the sympathetic system, depending on the activities and the calmness that one has between activities, will be sort of up and down. So I kind of learned all these things just by observing and then reading. I am a voracious reader and I read multiple different domains and disciplines, and then try and kind of bring them all together to see the connecting pieces. And now I can see all those connecting pieces really, really well. And since you asked about the nasal switching, that's somehow very, very amazingly connected to this whole thing, because the left nostril is somewhat more associated with the parasympathetic nervous system, and the right nostril is somewhat more associated with the sympathetic nervous system. So just as an experiment, if you ever want to calm down from a situation that you feel like is slightly little bit tense or something like that, and you just want to relax, try doing left nostril breathing. You can put your hand or you can put your finger on the index finger on the right nostril very lightly, and then just breathe through the left nostril very slowly. It will calm you down. And similarly, on the other hand, if you want to rev up, you're sort of having a groggy early morning and you want to sort of get energy, get going, do the same on the other side. So cover your left nostril and just breathe slowly through the right nostril a few times, and you might see that your energy level has kind of gone up because the sympathetic system gets triggered.
That's very interesting, and appreciate those little tips. One thing I want to go back to, and you didn't necessarily say this, but maybe imply, but I wanted your thoughts on this. So indirectly, I then picked up, could dopamine hits from scrolling social media essentially be similar to the fight or flight response where your body is more active? So therefore, arguably, your digestive system, your rest is not as calm. So it's impacting you on that side as well. So dopamine can have to some degree similar effect as cortisol. Is that accurate?
So yeah, so actually the the brain is anticipating in some sense that on one side it seems like it's pleasure, and that's why the dopamine effect, but at the same time it's kind of complicated, I think, because you're absolutely right. On one hand, it feels like something that is good, something that one is looking forward to, and dopamine is more related to the expectation that something happening and something seems to be good in a way, and hence sort of pleasure, right? And expectation that it's going to be good. But obviously there is a repetitive addiction component to it. So I suspect the way it is, a brain, like I said, not formed for millions of years, and today's modern world is probably like a second of time in the day of the brain that we have, or the genes that we have. So it's really a very, very, very small time of a few hundred years, and especially the digital era that we are in. And since I sort of come from the world of finance, I can see the parallels as well, that the digital era in our health life is also very, very recent. I mean, it's really when early 2000s and is when social media was born, and the ubiquitous iPhone, which I love as well, came in 2008, and that's what brought the screens everywhere. So it's all like 15 years, right? We are in 2024, and it's not a whole lot of time for us to truly understand from a thousands of years time frame as to what's really going on. But yeah, I think what is probably happening is that we anticipate something good because, by nature, our physiology is to look for new things. So curiosity makes us, get that dopamine kick. But then that kind of takes over, that kind of becomes part of a repetitive loop. And that's why we have the issues with the technology addiction more and more at a younger age now. And that's leading to the mental health epidemic to some extent, because people don't want to meet each other, see each other. They are just on their screens all the time, right? The latest research I saw showed that between 2003 and 22, when the data is available, I think the amount of physical interactions have gone down in different age groups by anywhere between 10 to 20% to 45% in the teenage age group. It's like half of what it used to be. That I was used to, and maybe you were used to in earlier in your childhood. So, you know, a lot of these things going on together. And then on the other hand, the pathway of these fight or flight is very, very old. That's like an ancient kind of a pathway, that there is a danger, and that danger means cortisol, right? The danger means norepinephrine and cortisol, which I think kind of curiously combines together to sort of have a situation where it's both seemingly we are getting ready for that challenge and that danger, and that danger may be really most likely not a danger at all. It might be just the, let's say, the boss in office saying something which is sort of criticizing or negative, and that's being interpreted as a serious survival challenge, and then the heart rate goes up, and then the some relationship issue, a small issue, but then that gets interpreted as again a survival challenge, and the system goes on super panic mode and ready mode. But at the same time, on the other hand, the tech seems to be in a way a little bit harmless and so on and so forth. It seems like a distraction, but then that kind of builds another sort of maybe new issue there, which was not part of our old genes in a way. So we are actually forming our genes for tomorrow, right, in some sense. And hopefully we are at the peak of the tech addiction and it doesn't increase beyond what it is already.
That's a very good point, because you're right. I hadn't considered that we are forming the genes of the future by the actions we're participating in. Even if it's just on a small dosage, it's still impacting us over there. And man, what some scary statistics to think about, you know, people being 45% less active or present than they used to be as it relates to human interaction. So some very interesting thoughts. And it's wild to think how much of that is rooted in the ability to breathe and understand your breath and control your body and dopamine and cortisol and digestive system and all the other things that are related to that. So first principles kind of thinking on that side.
Correct. First principles thinking from how it all connects together, how we have the ability to control pretty much everything as we start gaining back control from in a way the variety of stressors, the variety of situations that seem outside our control, but then also using technology in a way such that, you know, we get the information, we get the insights to be able to sort of activate the right knobs to bring back more and more agency, more and more control, and in a sense more and more proactive health and happiness. So that's kind of why we kind of combine the idea of breath, which is in a way the connecting pieces to everything, and AI which we are going to see more and more. And I think there is just no turning back, and you know, technology always moves forward in some sense. I think what is important is for us to use it in the right way and to the, you know, right, in a sense, evolution to be able to become better over a period of time. And that's why I combined that breath and AI to make it breath AI.
I love it. Well, thank you for sharing the details behind some of that stuff. Is there anything else you wanted to dive in?
I think that's probably about it. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you being on today, and thank you for being there. And I look forward to what you're doing with Breath AI, and let us know when it's out there. And it's definitely interesting for me. So thank you for sharing about that.
Thanks, Alex, and I hope this reaches out to many other Wharton Executive Education alumni. Me, absolutely greatly impacted, inspired some of the stuff being done. I do believe that the roots of that go back to the Steinberg Hall, the time that I put there, the eye-opening talks that I had from many interesting professors, the interactions with the wide global audience that we had, many games stroke case studies that we played with. I think all of that, all I would say, was truly responsible. So hopefully this reaches out to many more of the Wharton executive education sort of listeners. And I hope that if anybody has any interesting ideas about how this is actually the idea of Breathe AI is to hopefully impact millions and then billions to become healthy and happy. And if anybody has any suggestions, ideas, thoughts, we'll be happy to hear those and collaborate.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Alex.